This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Stuart Harrington, spent most of his life in the world of spies and double agents. He served 30 years as an Army military intelligence officer. From 1988 to 92, he directed the FCA, the Foreign Counterintelligence Activity, which was responsible for pursuing the most damaging cases of espionage committed against the U.S. by the Soviets. He's written a new book called Traitors Among Us, Inside the Spycatcher's World. The case of Clyde Lee Conrad, which Harrington worked on and writes about in the book, has a few parallels to the current Chinese espionage story. Conrad was an American military officer who spent most of his career in West Germany. He ran a spy ring that sold secret American documents to the Soviets detailing NATO defense plans in the event of a Soviet attack on Eastern Europe. After a long investigation by the Foreign Counterintelligence Activity, Conrad was tried and convicted of high treason in Germany and sentenced to life. He died in prison last year at the age of 50. Conrad was the custodian of the top-secret documents that he ended up selling.
Conrad worked in the G3, which is the Operations and Plans and Training section of the 8th Infantry Division, and essentially as a sergeant, staff sergeant, and sergeant first class in that section. His job was to work the war plans and the annual revisions of the war plans, which dealt with how that division would react, where it would go, and what it would do in the event of a war. He was a clever fellow, however, and he used that position in order to obtain war plans for adjacent units, other units, higher level units, and amassed for himself, just by virtue of being in the war plans job, a huge family of war plans that he could then betray, in this case, to the Hungarian Military Intelligence Service, which passed them on to Moscow.
Now, what was his motivation for selling the secrets? Was it ideology or just money?
Money. To Conrad, the Cold War, in his mind's eye, he rationalized that the Cold War was a great game, that there never really would be a war, and therefore smart people like Conrad, who sold the war plans and profited from it, were far ahead of those who took the whole thing seriously and did their job.
Now, in the book, you describe how his reputation among his superiors was that he was great. He was like the model employee, but he had a different reputation to soldiers.
Yes, Conrad was, as I said in the book, a chameleon. He was certainly a highly respected non-commissioned officer in the headquarters of the 8th Infantry Division and stayed there year after year. He'd made himself the indispensable man, and he was the perfect soldier to his superiors. But amongst his non-commissioned officer peers, and above all, amongst the younger enlisted people who looked to him as a role model and a father figure, he was a cynical, Machiavellian, and quite honestly greedy fellow, and an opportunist who made no secret about his contempt for authority.
And someone who would occasionally approach, you know, a soldier and say, you want to make a little money on the side?
He did that, and one of the lessons learned from the saga of Clyde Lee Conrad and his co-conspirators, something we've known all along, which is soldiers are very reticent to squeal on anybody who's got anything going on the side, at least during that period of time, the peer pressure to keep your mouth shut, and you know, people knew Clyde had something going, and he gave a different excuse for why he was, you know, getting his money and for offering these jobs to different soldiers. But nobody, almost nobody, walked in and said, hey, I think something's wrong with Conrad. You need to look closely at him.
Well, what intelligence ended up doing was taking one of the intelligence agents and basically making him a double agent. This was somebody named Danny Wilson, who Conrad had approached once and said, you know, you want to make some money on the side, hoping that he could sell secrets. And explain how you used Danny Wilson as a double agent.
Well, it was a gambit, you know, and it was a bold gambit that was actually commenced by my predecessor, a colonel named Bob Lund, wherein they'd identified Conrad, and it sure looked like he was the man. He'd had the access for the years. He had shown signs of undue affluence, more money than he should have had, gone from rags to riches. But the real challenge, of course, anytime you get a suspect in your sights, is to document the elements of the crime of espionage. And you've got to be more specific than just, he looks like our boy. So in this particular case, the decision was made to take a young soldier whom Conrad had approached with an opportunity to make some easy money a number of years earlier, almost a decade earlier, and who had, during interviewing, reported later, years later, to our agents that Conrad had asked him about a chance to make some quick money on the side, and essentially to transfer that soldier back into the area where he could restrike up a relationship with Conrad, and just see if Conrad might take the bait, view the young soldier as someone who hadn't reported the problem at the beginning and therefore might be trustworthy, and he might take him into his confidence and try to recruit him. And that's what we did.
Did it work?
It worked. Conrad was apparently at that point in time, he'd recently retired. He didn't have direct access to secrets as he'd had in the past. He was what I called at the time the once-and-future spy. He'd like to have gotten back in the saddle and resumed his stature as the pride of Hungary's, of Budapest's agent stable. And when Danny Wilson walked into his life, Conrad, after an initial fright, thinking that Wilson might be there to actually apprehend him, saw daylight. He saw pure opportunity in his old friend Danny, and in a matter of months, he began to brag about his espionage career and ultimately recruited Danny with the dangling in front of him the visions of a lot of money to be made by a smart guy off this game called the Cold War.
What was your biggest frustration when you took over the Army's foreign counterintelligence activity in 1988? Your biggest frustration in terms of this case?
Well, I was told by my superiors when they gave me the new job that the case, which was called Canasta Player, was the major challenge, that the case had been open for a decade, that for more than 2 years, Conrad had been identified, but closing on the target and collecting the information, which would then be assessed by prosecutors as adequate to lay hands on Conrad and arrest him, was the challenge. The word was out that the foreign counterintelligence activity had gotten a hold of this tiger by the tail called the suspect Clyde Lee Conrad and just didn't know how to bring the thing to a conclusion so that prosecutors could say, yes, we've got what we need. There's no question about it. The elements of the crime of espionage have been met. It's time to grab him.
What was the turning point in actually ending the case?
Well, I'd like to say that we had a great plan and we proceeded step by step and the case ended on our terms. Actually, the turning point was at the time when we were doing well in manipulating the case to where we were collecting those elements of information about Conrad, such as where his money was, who was his Hungarian contact. A member of the media, one who's quite well known today, Jeff Girth, actually picked up a tip. In spite of all of the security surrounding this case, Jeff picked up a tip that this case was underway and approached the government to see if he could verify whether the tip was correct or not. And that approach by Jeff Girth was actually a traumatic event, and it forced us into going on a route to bring the case to an end that we had not planned to do, which was to go to our German colleagues in the then West German government, and ask for assistance in arresting and prosecuting Conrad.
And that's why he ended up getting tried and arrested and imprisoned in Germany.
That's correct. The Germans were as aggrieved a party as we were. In fact, you could argue even more aggrieved, since any war that would have resulted in catastrophe out of Conrad's betrayal would have been fought on the battlefield of West Germany, not in Pennsylvania. So what we had to essentially take a case that had a cloak of security around it so dense that we didn't dare tell the Germans about it, even though we'd been investigating for a decade in their country. And we had to go to the Germans, I had to go to the Germans and say, look, this is what we have been doing in your country behind your back. It was a deep secret, security was essential, and we now find ourselves in a position where the whole thing is on thin ice based upon a leak to the media. Our own prosecutors are not really ready to make the jump as to, you know, stepping up to the plate and prosecuting, and we need your help. And the Germans responded gratefully, with a positive response, and the rest is history.
My guest is Stuart Harrington, and he directed the Army's foreign counterintelligence activity from 1988 to 92. He's written a new book called Traitors Among Us, Inside the Spy Catcher's World. You were based in Berlin during part of your career. What was it like working in Berlin during the Cold War?
Well, it was, of course, for those of us who were blessed to serve there, for professional and personal reasons, a great experience. Professionally, of course, Berlin was the Mecca for espionage. It was what Istanbul was 75 years earlier, or Vienna, the place where the major adversaries in the Cold War came into direct contact because the city itself was divided amongst communist and non-communist parties. And so from that perspective, it was professionally extremely gratifying because you had the chance to actually lock horns with the adversary, whereas a lot of counterintelligence folks would spend a career and never get that opportunity. There were a lot of games being played in Berlin, and the watchword was that nothing is as it appears to be.
What's it like to work in a world where nothing is where it appears to be? Do you start to distrust everything, everybody?
Again, a wise observation on your part. I think one of the occupational illnesses of working in the counterintelligence arena is a tendency to become almost paranoid. Since nothing can be accepted at face value, you know, going across the line to where things are face value and how one copes with them, I think that's a real problem. It was for me and was for a lot of my agents. An innocuous phone call, for example, by someone or an innocuous meeting in an airport terminal causes one to think, you know, I wonder if the reason she asked me that question is she's trying to get close to me. Why did she sit down next to me and strike up that conversation? Is she for real, or has someone instructed her to try and get close to me for the worst of possible reasons? Those kinds of thoughts and second guessing tend to characterize the way one becomes when one's subjected to that environment year after year.
Now, I'm wondering if the paranoia you describe also filters into the political level. In other words, if you risk becoming more paranoid about an enemy country than maybe they deserve. In other words, if you were more fearful about the Soviets during the Cold War than perhaps you needed to be.
Well, I think I say in Traitors Among Us that we certainly painted our adversary as a 10-foot-tall adversary, and intelligence people are very good at that, not because of the more cynical reasons evinced by the commentators on the system, namely that, you know, the threat is painted very, very overpainted and overdrawn greatly for resource reasons. But I think there's a very real tendency when you focus and focus intently on a target to begin to be a little bit cowed and overawed by that target and to overstate its threat. The Chinese case, for example, I read the Cox report, and I consider it to be tremendously overdrawn and worst-cased. And yet I can see in that the product of inputs from a lot of intelligence community folks.
What do you think is overdrawn about that report?
Well, I think it's the rhetoric largely. I mean, nobody would dispute that the Chinese government has a program in order to collect military intelligence and economic intelligence from the United States. And in that sense, the Chinese government's doing nothing more and nothing less than what all governments do, including our own. But the rhetoric with which the report is framed and the way it just, the overall sense and feeling of that report strikes me as, you know, somewhat evidence of the same kind of occupational paranoia that we've talked about.
My guest is retired Colonel Stuart Harrington. His new book is called Traitors Among Us. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Stuart Harrington, and he ran the Army's Foreign Counterintelligence Activity from 1988 to 92. His new book is called Traitors Among Us, Inside the Spy Catcher's World. Now, you were in the position of being the Army's head counterintelligence agent at a time when the Cold War was ending. You say in your book you didn't see it coming.
Well, I wished I could say, it sounds like a broken record, I wished I could say that I'd seen it coming. But the truth of the matter is we were so completely consumed with the serious hemorrhages of national security that were on our plate and the need to focus on collecting the elements of the crime of espionage, not only on Clyde Conrad, but as readers will find out, there are a total of 11 co-conspirators of this ring, not to mention other cases that we had underway, that from the point of view of counterintelligence folks, we didn't see it coming. And I think if you look across the board at the performance of the U.S. government at the highest levels, that when Ronald Reagan said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, everybody snickered and it was regarded as just so much rhetoric. But the truth is that the Soviet system was shot through with vulnerabilities. They knew it better than anyone, particularly the KGB knew of the vulnerabilities better than anyone. And they had a better sense of their own system than we did, that's for sure.
You briefly describe in your book that after the Cold War, you were working on a project for which you ended up flying in the same plane as a former KGB official. And so you got a chance to, you know, share stories with your former arch foe. What was that experience like?
Well, you know, I had quite a lot of time to talk to this KGB colonel because we flew all the way across from Moscow to Vladivostok. You know, my first thought was I never thought in my career that I'd ever have the opportunity to sit on an aircraft and talk with one of these folks and watch him as he consumed the vodka and sausage that was, you know, his desire, and ever get a conversation going with him. And it was almost surrealistic. But equally interesting was to hear, you know, his view of things. For example, I'll never forget when he told me that Gorbachev was a CIA agent dispatched by the CIA or recruited by the CIA to destroy the Soviet Union.
He believed that.
He believed that right down to the very fiber of his existence, and that the whole fall of the Soviet Union was essentially a massively successful and orchestrated CIA plot.
Now, do you think that that's a symptom of the kind of paranoia, that spy's experience that you were describing before?
More than that, Terry, what I saw in that was, and again, it wasn't just this one officer I got to talk to. I spent a lot of time talking with a lot of them. It was the institutional paranoia of the security services playing, you know, the mirror image of us, although far more amplified, I would say, plus the tremendous paranoia that tends to characterize the Russians, particularly now in the days when their superpower status is gone. There's a tremendous amount of paranoia and wound-licking going on over there, and I had a chance to experience it firsthand.
Now, you're in private practice, I suppose I could say now. You're the manager of investigations for a major sporting goods company. I don't know the name of the country, and I'm not sure you'd want to name it yourself. But I think your presence there is really part of a trend in which former spies and detectives and FBI agents and CIA agents are going to work in private industry. And I'm wondering what you think that says.
Well, first of all, my skills are a pretty low-density skill, meaning that, you know, the average person out there doesn't really have a need to hire a spy catcher. Yet the investigative discipline itself, there are fields such as protecting the intellectual property of a sporting goods company, which is what I do, wherein protecting intellectual property, in this case, trademarks, patents, trade dress, there's an analogy there. You know, in my former life, I protected national security information from those who would take it in order to use it against us strategically. And in my new life, I essentially work for a very fine sporting goods company that is famous for its intellectual property protection. And the targets are no longer spies who would steal the information in order to give it to some hostile military power, but rather those who would steal the information in order to counterfeit products, to make knockoffs of products, or otherwise to disadvantage the public corporation for which I work and impact negatively on its stockholders and ultimately, in the macro sense, our national economy.
The atmosphere must be pretty different when you're trying to protect information from getting into the hands of opponent, you know, of competing businesses compared to trying to protect information state secrets from getting into the hands of, you know, enemy countries.
Well, in many cases, the countries are out there. It's actually a transnational thing. The people who are trying to get the information are in foreign countries, and they have very healthy, well-developed industries based on counterfeiting and the lack of respect for intellectual property. And in other cases, it's unscrupulous people who, I must say, these people are more unscrupulous and far more dangerous and cause me far greater worry than the spies we caught.
In what way are they more unscrupulous?
Well, what they will do in order to obtain the information and the kinds of attitude they take towards people who rain on their parade.
Did your people ever use James Bond kind of gizmos to help them find spies, find traitors?
Well, we had quite an array of electronic aids at our disposal, a lot of which to this very day are, you know, we don't talk about for smart reasons. You know, things like tracking beepers installed in a hidden place on Clyde Conrad's car so that our surveillance aircraft could keep track of him when he headed out of the village and got on the Autobahn, that sort of stuff, wiretaps and that sort of stuff was all a part of it. And again, You can't do that sort of electronic intrusion or those sorts of, you know, gee whiz type devices without some kind of approval where you've got probable cause to suspect someone's loyalty. But we had a fair share of those arrows in our quiver.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there were any gizmos that originated in the spy world that you've now seen filter down to, you know, like, say, the Sharper Image Catalog or, you know, just like consumer products.
Spy mania is alive and well in the United States, and you can go online now and you can buy a wide array of stuff, which in the case of my agents, if one of us were to have gone out and bought that stuff for our own private use, we would have been in trouble. There are things that as a government agent, you know, you can't mess with, and you're forbidden. An example is what you would call commonly burglar tools. We have our own lock-picking specialists in the government, but those tools and the possession of those tools are, you know, a special thing, and he's not allowed to take them out and keep them in the trunk of his car once he's trained in that specialty. So there's a lot of that spy stuff out there, wild stuff, electronic stuff, bugs of every shape, size, and description, pinhole cameras, you name it. It's all out there.
Well, Stuart Harrington, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it a lot.
Stuart Harrington's new book is called Traitors Among Us, Inside the Spy Catcher's World. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.